Morning. Next Sunday will be Ascension, with, of course, its own readings. And the following Sunday, Pentecost, with its own readings and its own emphasis. So today, we bring to a close the tour of the Gospel of John that we've been taking through the whole of the Lent and Easter seasons. We conclude with chapter 17, Jesus' great prayer that wraps up the heart of the gospel. Very next chapter, after Jesus finishes this prayer, he says, and he got up and went to the garden. From there on is chapter 18, the arrest and the trial. 19, the crucifixion and the death. 20 and 21, the resurrection and the appearances. So this is the end of the ministry in John. It's being tied up and presented for your observation. It's also a great place to look at what John is doing and how he does it. Ever watch some of those archaeological shows on television and they show you a bulk, you know, where you can see 5 or 6 or 20 feet of earth in layers? You can say, now this is the civilization that was here, and then 200 years before that was this one, and 100 years before that. You can literally see the layers laid out like a little slice of a layer cake. Well, same sort of thing happens in John. Scholars identify as many as 5 different layers, from an original witness to the tradition, the disciple whom Jesus loved, to a final editor who's making sure everything is just so in place. Well, we see this 5th layer, the final editor, this morning, don't we? Here we have Jesus very earnestly at prayer. Give glory to your Son, that your Son may glorify you, that he may give them eternal life. And then all of a sudden the voice changes. I tried to change the voice in it, both the pitch and the timbre and whatnot in the middle, so that you almost hear the bracket, closed bracket. Now this is eternal life, that they should know you, the only true God, and the one whom you sent, Jesus Christ. Were that not an editorial addition, you would have Jesus referring to himself in the third person by name and by title. Nowhere else in the Gospels does Jesus ever call himself Jesus, much less Jesus Christ. This is a top layer. The word phrase eternal life has been used, and he wants to clarify it. Now, what does this mean by eternal life? So he puts it in there. You get similar little things running through the gospel in that tidying up editor phase. Below that, you've got a final composition phase. And before that, you've got some editorial phases. And we see that here in this section, this discourse after the Last Supper. Chapter 14 was probably layer 3. One chapter, which we heard last week, talking about glory, talking about unity. Now, when it comes to an end, the end verse of chapter 14 is, "Arise, let us go." But they don't. Jesus goes on talking for 2 more chapters and praying for 1 more chapter. But if listen to this as though it were together. I'm going to move from the end of 14 to the beginning of 16, or beginning of 18. "But the world must know that I love the Father, and that I do just as the Father has commanded me. Get up. Let us go." When he had said this, Jesus went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley to where there was a garden. Seems right through. Next layer, you get a reprise of 14 that becomes 16, and 2 variations on the theme, the vine and the branches part in 15, and this prayer in 17, which reprises all of the themes. It started out talking about glory, And sure enough, that's what we've got here. The hour has come. Give glory to your Son, that your Son may glorify you. Glory. Interesting phrase, word, in this context. What is this context? This is just before they go to the garden. This is, in effect, John's version of Jesus' prayer in the garden. Because once he gets there in John, there is no prayer, much less agony. There's no agony in the garden in John. That's sort of unbecoming for his portrait of Jesus, so he airbrushes that out. And the prayer, which in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is the famous, "Get me out of this! But if I really gotta, I will." Prayer. Very different tone from, "Father, give glory to your Son, that your Son may give glory to you." What is this talking about? His death is giving glory. When in the other three Gospels, there's this focus on the horrible aspect, prospect of crucifixion. Do we have schizophrenia going on? Or is one of these simply right and the other wrong? The one accurate and the other inaccurate? I don't think so. I think what we have here is a retelling of the story from a different perspective, with a broader lens, if you will, from a greater distance, looking at not the facts of what happened, but the significance of what is happening. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, here and throughout their Gospels, are much more focused in on who Jesus was, what Jesus said, what Jesus did. We get a much different flavor of language on Jesus' lips in the synoptics than we do in John. And it's probably much closer to what Jesus actually sounded like when they were listening to him in Galilee or in Jerusalem. John, on the other hand, steps back from the canvas a bit. It's like looking at Impressionist painting. You get too close, all you see are the little dots. You back up, you can see what's going on. Well, what's going on is, for John, very simple. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of an only Son coming forth from the Father. So the whole narrative is told in the light of that ultimate significance, that Jesus comes forth from God and returns to God. "Glorify me, Father, with the glory that I had with you before the world began." This goes all the way back to the beginning of John's Gospel. Ties right back into the prologue. What we're doing is taking back a step, taking a longer look, to see the significance of what's going on. For all their immediate horror, the crucifixion and death are a pivot point. They're the end of Jesus' incarnation. He becomes completely who we are. Nobody has become completely human until they have died. When he's lived a life and died a death, then you're fully a human being. He is completely one with us. And at the same time, the beginning of that return, having come forth from the Father, he now goes back to the Father, this time with us in tow. So the tremendous significance for us is brought out by this prayer, by this whole section. It's being interpreted. Jesus came forth from the Father in order to gather us together and bring us back with him to God. So this is profoundly true, although it is much less historical than the synoptics. At least mostly, there are places where John has apparently relevant historical details that the others have missed. But mostly, they're a lot closer to the action, telling us a lot more about what Jesus looked like, what he sounded like, what he did, what he taught. John is much more backed off and interpretive, telling us what it all means for us. So they both tell us the truth. But they tell us the truth in answer to two different questions. If you try to swap them, you get it wrong. You need to interpret the answer in light of what is the question. If you want to hear the prayer that Jesus taught us, you will hear echoes of it here in this prayer in chapter 17. All the themes are there. Read any of the scholarly analyses. They'll show you how much the Our Father underlies this prayer. But you can't back translate it into Aramaic. It was clearly written in very elegant Greek. Whereas the text of the Lord's Prayer that we have in Matthew and Luke, once you combine and compare the two, it back translates into Aramaic very well. You can figure out what it actually sounded like when Jesus prayed it with his disciples. They both give us the truth. They both give us important truths, but it's important to see them each in their own function. So during this week, as you're completing your reading and meditation on John, look for the evidence of the different layers, but more importantly, look for the answers to the questions that John is presenting answers to, not exactly what happened or how did it happen. If you'd been in Jerusalem that night, you probably would have heard something a lot more like, "Father, get me out of this," than this, "Give your son glory that your son may glorify you." But rather, a very thorough approach after 70 years of prayer and meditation to the significance questions. What does this mean? What does it mean for God? What does it mean for Jesus? What does it mean for us? Sometimes it's only in the long run that you can see the significance. It's only by backing up from the historical details that you can see what's really happening.